Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're starting our show today by talking with you about wild rice. It's a unique crop. It's considered sacred to indigenous people in Wisconsin and neighboring states. There are several threats to wild rice. We'll talk about the crop in general, but also talk about those threats with two guests we have for you. One is Kathleen Smith from the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Kathleen, welcome to the show.
Bonjour.
Jason Fleener, a wildlife habitat specialist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, our other guest today. And Jason, welcome to you.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
And great to have you with us. You can join the conversation as well as you listen along. Maybe you have questions about wild rice, its history, or some of its threats. Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Kathleen, let's start with you. Where does wild rice grow in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest?
So it has such a wonderful habitat, a beautiful ecosystem. So we call it an indicator species for good, clean water. So it really loves the mucky substrate. It also loves good, clear water. It grows in about 3 foot of water. So you have an inlet and an outlet in a river system or a lake. So it just loves that good, clean water. So it's persistent in, you know, these areas where you have the ecosystem and all of our orders of creation that has these elements that come together in this beautiful space. So it ideally grows in about 3 feet of water along shorelines or riverine systems. So that's where, you know, our beautiful plant relative really likes to live.
And it's an annual plant, is it not?
Yes, it's an annual plant. So it has a beautiful life cycle. So once it matures, the seed, you know, goes into the substrate. It has this big, long on. It kind of feels like Velcro if you go one way. So when it drops and matures, it drops right into the sediment. So that's where it needs to know winter as well. So once it sits there and gets to know winter, that's where it's really important, you know, for the colder temperatures. We need to have snow and ice to be able to overwinter this beautiful relative of ours.
Yeah.
So once it starts germinating in the springtime, it germinates around 38 degrees or a little bit warmer. So then it becomes submergent. So that's where it kind of lives a little bit longer. And then once the sun kind of comes through, that's why you need good, clean water. And then it starts, you know, photosynthesizing once it gets to floating leaf stage, which is about June. And then in July, it's kind of starts standing up. So then that's where it starts making its own food, and then it starts maturing. So then later on, then you kind of get to the elder stage, I call it, you know, where it starts maturing, where about this time, you know, that seed is just ripening, getting ready to shatter so we can have it for harvest.
And it's a very nutritious food, is it not?
Yes, so Good nutritional value. So it has a higher quality of protein. It's gluten-free. It's a lot better than white rice and brown rice as well.
Yeah. Jason Fleener, turn to you for a minute. The DNR says this year's wild rice crop is low and maybe continuing a trend of recent years. What's causing the low production of wild rice?
Yeah, that's right. And really those the trend is statewide, unfortunately, and what we've been seeing over the course, what I would say the better part of 10 or 20 years is a decline. And some years we'll have some good years and off years. But if you look at the long term trend, it's not promising. The challenges of rice on every individual body of water are different. Some of them are more human influenced challenges with landscape use changes, influences on water flow, damming, culverts, things of that nature, recreational activities, boating and whatnot. But the overall, I guess, threat that's consistent across the board is climate change. And you know, that's due to a number of factors. And like, as Kathy mentioned, the rice, the species that we find here in Wisconsin really depend on those cold winters and ice cover to trigger germination in the spring. So as we encounter more and more of these warmer winters, it doesn't germinate as well. And what we're seeing is in these lakes, some of the competing aquatic plants, like water lily and water shield, for example, tend to have an edge and will outcompete rice under those conditions. And then you couple that with increased rainfall events. We're seeing more events, you know, the 3 to 5 inch plus rains during the vulnerable growing season in May through July. And that can cause a lot of turbidity, sedimentation, and uprooting of the growing rice plants. And then they are no longer successful in growing for that season.
Yeah. Well, Kathleen, your organization, again, I'll remind, the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, or GLIFWIC, I think it's called as well, said there was a draw about an 18% less of northern Wisconsin covered by wild rice than last year, which is quite a lot, quite a drop. How do you determine that?
So we determined it by, we have a remote sensing tool. We were able to do it from a scientific point of view as compared to previous year's wild rice. So that's how we were able to compare that, you know, there was a decline in Manoman.
And how large is the geographic area you and GLIFWIC oversee?
We actually oversee our ceded territories, so it's the 1836, 1837, 1842, and 1854 treaty area. So that's what we consider the ceded territory area. So it covers like the western UP, northern Wisconsin, and part of the eastern Minnesota.
That's a large area. Do you have authority, does GLIFWIC have authority to enforce environmental regulations that would protect wild rice beds?
So just our game wardens, they have the authority to do off-reservation. So that's what GLIFWIC does, is we do off-reservation regulations where tribes have their own resources to do their on-reservation. They kind of do their own regulations. So that's what GLIFWIC does, is we kind of, you know, regulate that for off reservation only.
Yeah. Jeff in White Bear Lake, Minnesota, couldn't stay with us, but wants to know why cultivated wild rice is so much different than wild rice that grows, truly grows wild.
So cultivated wild rice, it's genetically modified to ripen all at once, where wild rice is able to ripen at different rates. So that's how, you know, Mother Nature, or, you know, the Gitche Manitou, the creator, has, you know, made wild rice, because we also have to return some back, you know, for our other relatives, return some back for, you know, next year's crop.
And Jason, wild rice is considered a keystone plant species. I don't know, Kathleen might have even mentioned that. What does that mean, actually?
Yeah, it's really vital, critical to the ecosystem functions in a lot of these places where rice is found. There are so many different animals that depend on wild rice or Manoman, you know, so it's not only important for human harvesting and food, but a lot of animals really deeply depend on it. Waterfowl, in particular, ducks love wild rice, and other types of birds, sora rails, blackbirds, muskrats really depend on those ecosystems. And when they're not functioning properly, it kind of throws the ecosystem out of balance.
Yeah, for sure. Kathleen, your title at Glyphwic is She Who Takes Care of the Rice in the Anishinaabe language. I'm wondering, what was your background, and was this position created specifically because of your connection with communities that have long harvested Manuman?
So my position title, that's a very good question. It's Gunawing Dung Manuman, She Who Takes Care of the Wild Rice. So this position was created after Peter and Lisa David had retired from Glyphwic, and tribes actually wanted to have their own cultural perspective. So that's how my position was created. So I bring in the cultural perspective into co-management or co-stewardship, you know, decisions. So we have a great way of bringing in teachings and our traditions, you know, into management decisions. So that's how my position was created.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that it was specifically created. And your background, you have some prior experience to assuming this position.
Yes, I have. I actually worked for my own community, which is located in the Western UP. I'm located in the Launce Indian Reservation, also known as Kuna Bay Indian Community. I was a habitat specialist for my own tribe. I did a lot of native plant restoration, also invasive species program I was a part of, the food sovereignty, which included the community garden. So we also, you know, collected seed and, you know, planted our own medicines as well, you know, because we had brownfield sites in our community because of legacy mining. So we had a lot of stamp sand. The tribe had actually procured this property from the state, which was it's called Sand Point Restoration Site. So we had actually remediated the area and put our own native plant species onto this cap. So that was a little bit of my background, and it also included wild rice restoration. I worked for my tribe for about 6 years. So we actually got seed, and we were able to have, you know, this beautiful medicine, Manuman, in our own community as well.
What does a restoration project look like?
As far as for wild rice? So what we do is we assess the area to see if it has, you know, the inlet and outlet, like I had spoken about. You have to have that gentle flow of water. You also have to have a mucky substrate, and also the ideal conditions is around 3 feet of water. I've seen Manuman grow in, you know, very minimal, like 1 inch of water, all the way up to about 6 feet of water, depending on, you know, the issues that the beautiful connections that it needs to grow. So that's what we first look for, is to see if there's prime habitat. And, you know, we kind of look at the ecological area to see if it will, you know, hold our beautiful relative. Usually Manuman will grow, you know, the first year that you put seed in. If the nutrients is still there, it will still, you know, return back year after year. Sometimes these wild rice beds need to rest, and so it can build up that nutrient cycle back again. So that's when you have a lot of, they call it crop failure. I don't really like to call it a failure, but, you know, as long as it can rest and the nutrients can build back, the Manuman stocks actually take about 2 years to return back to the earth and become a nutrient.
Oh, my goodness. And where do you get the seed?
So we get the seed. A lot of tribes are, they love to harvest their own seed from their own area. But we actually get seed sometimes from Minnesota. But a lot of tribes are trying to bring in, you know, seed from the local area as well. Minnesota actually has the lakes to be able to, you know, procure the seed and to be able to, you know, help other communities along that want Manuman in their area. But they have the lakes where you can go out and you can harvest anywhere from 400 pounds up, depending on, you know, your skills. Here in Wisconsin, it's a lot less because we have a lot less, you know, bigger beds as compared to Minnesota. So for my tribe, we actually go to Minnesota to get the seed, you know, and bring back, because it is the same species as any illustrious.
It's interesting. And do you procure the seed the way it was always done in canoes or other boats, or what do you do?
So how we get the seed is we always harvest in a traditional manner. I do a lot of rice camps as well. So we teach a lot of participants, the proper way of harvesting in a sustainable way. So I always call it light hand on the land. So we use a canoe, which can't be any bigger than 17 foot long versus, 38 inches wide. And then you have two participants in the canoe. One will have a push pole and the other one will have rice knockers. So what you do is you gently bend the stems over your canoe and then you tap the stems so you don't break it because it continues to ripen, like I had said earlier. You want to have enough seed on, there'll be enough seed on there so somebody else can come back and harvest again. But that's how the seed is procured, in that traditional manner, especially for our restoration projects. We take pride in, in our harvest as a people. So when we do have somebody that, gives the or offers their seed up, for restoration, they always make sure and they check and, is the seed growing, because we all just take pride in that.
Really interesting interesting talking with our two guests today. Kathleen Smith is the Manuman Gatawandang Ojibwe for Who Takes Care of the Rice with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. And Jason Fleener, a wetland habitat specialist for the Wisconsin DNR. Great to have them with us. And I hope you'll join in. If you have a question or comment about wild rice or growing it or what's going on with it, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about wild rice on the program. Up next, we'll talk with Nick Roy about how state carbon fees on greenhouse gas emissions could lower utility bills for homes and business owners in Wisconsin. And at 12:30, Jeb Barzin and Christina Weld from the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council talk about a new Burn Boss certification program. But right now, we're talking wild rice, and I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments. You can reach us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. And Kathleen, before we take any calls, it's Manuman or wild rice is, it's not just food to the Anishinaabe peoples. It's a spirit.
No, it isn't.
Go ahead.
No, it isn't. It's one of our plant relatives, and it sits in that second order order of creation. So it's a beautiful plant relative of ours.
Yeah. And Jason, I want to get back to you for a minute. Who can harvest wild rice in Wisconsin?
Yeah. So harvesting for wild rice is really open to all residents of Wisconsin. Unfortunately, we don't allow out-of-state harvesters. There are some exceptions to the rule. As Kathy alluded to earlier with the ceded territories, there are treaty rights, the Ojibwe people who have rights to harvest in Wisconsin, whether if they're from Minnesota or Michigan or Wisconsin tribes. Other than that, anybody else can harvest wild rice as long as they're a resident of Wisconsin.
And need to be licensed.
Correct. You would need a license if you're between the ages of 17 and 64. If you're younger or older than that range, then one would not have to purchase a license.
John in South Range has a question. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hi. Actually, I have more than one. I'm glad you picked this topic. It's unusual, but it pertains to our area for sure. Let's see. Well, the first one was that is the decreasing harvest. Is that a bellwether or a canary in the coal mine for other things in the environment? So when this is threatened, are there other things that also may be having an effect because of warming? And you may have covered this earlier. Is it actually a rice, wild rice?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then if you have time for the third one, have there ever been like archaeological discoveries of the oldest existence of wild rice in a settlement?
Hmm. Okay. Interesting questions, John. And well, let's take the one question about is wild rice a rice? And Kathleen, do you want to take that?
Yes, wild rice is actually considered a grain, specifically a whole grain. So it's actually a seed of an aquatic grass, so it's not really a true rice.
Okay, and what about this wild rice being a bellwether? We did address that a little bit, but Jason?
Yeah, actually, Glyphwick has done a climate change vulnerability assessment for a number of different species, and actually what arose to the top in terms of most vulnerable, unfortunately, was wild rice, I believe. So, yeah, to that point, I think, you know, that could be a sign of risks of things to come for other species as well.
And archaeological, is there, I don't know, Kathleen, if you're familiar, or Jason for that matter, but Kathleen, will maybe go to you first. Archaeological findings of, you know, the original, you know, going back a long way in terms of its history, wild rice?
I haven't heard of any cases of that, but that doesn't say that, you know, wild rice was potentially found in archaeological areas, but I'm not aware of any cases at this moment.
But it's kind of been there and used by native peoples for forever, pretty much, has it? I mean, at least that's the thinking?
Yes, it has. So we actually came here from the Atlantic Ocean, you know, coming through the St. Lawrence River system. So we traveled and migrated this way to go where the food grows on the water. So it's been believed, you know, that journey had taken, you know, thousands of years for us to get here. So that was through a prophecy. So Manoman, you know, is one of our four main feast foods. So it's really it's a really beautiful relative that helps us, you know, kind of sustains our way of life today.
Let's, John, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's turn to Claire in Sauk County.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. Kathleen mentioned motorboats, and that inspired my questions. Does wild rice grow above the water level? Is it visible? And number two, do kayaks, canoes, paddle boards, et cetera, non-motorized craft, do they harm the wild rice?
Okay. Jason, do you want to start?
Sure. Wild rice, is a grass. So it actually does, it's an emergent wetland plant. So which means that it starts by growing underwater in the sediment, and then it goes through a life cycle where it reaches a floating leaf stage to the top of the water, and eventually the full plant will emerge out of the water, and it could stick anywhere from a foot out of water up to 8 feet. And what we really haven't talked about yet is that there's actually two different species of wild rice in Wisconsin. That for all intents and purposes, the one that we talk about the most is what we call northern wild rice, or Azania palustris. the other species, the southern rice, or Zizania aquatica, which is actually much taller, but ironically, the seeds are smaller, so which is much less used for harvesting. So you would find that plant more frequently in river bottoms, especially in southern Wisconsin, Mississippi River systems.
Does anybody harvest that southern?
Not that I'm aware of. I'm sure there's been attempts, but I think a lot of people give up when they try. But to the caller's other question about boating, motor boating certainly does cause a threat, especially with the wake action or wave action that actually uproots plants. But more of the non-motorized watercraft is much better, I guess, for rice beds. Paddle boats or like more flat bottom boats can actually like mush or mash down the plants as you're going over on top of it. So it's a little more intrusive. That's why people harvest wild rice via canoe, where it has a tip or point that kind of parts the grass, if you will.
Oh, that makes that makes very good sense. And Rob emailed to ask how Ojibwe migration, how that story demonstrates the value of wild rice to Native peoples. Kathleen.
Oh, yes. So we value Manoman, you know, that's like a spiritual being, because it was, you know, it was told by prophecy for us to go where the food grows on the water. So initially in the Atlantic area, you know, we were foretold to go where the food grows on the water, because if we stayed, we would perish, meaning that the resources were kind of getting stretched, you know, on the Atlantic seaboard. So that's why we had this this prophecy and believe it, you know, it's like faith. So we did, you know, begin that journey along the St. Lawrence River. It's just really a profound story, you know, to have that faith to go where the food grows on the water. So we actually followed a Mita shell in the sky, you know, to where we know Madeline Island is like the center of it, this Great Lakes Basin, for, you know, where Manoman resides today.
And so the slowly, or maybe not so slowly, traveled across the country following wild rice.
Yes, so we actually had settlements along the way. There's a book called The Mishomas Book by Eddie Benton Benet. He talks about, you know, that journey where we had actually stops. There was like fishing villages. We would stop and, you know, and camp. And, you know, eventually a group of people would continue, you know, with the migration, you know, coming westward, you know. Well, that's where we kind of settled today in this space, you know, the Great Lakes Basin.
It's kind of interesting as I think about your work. Let me ask it this way. How do you combine your knowledge of the cultural meaning of Manoman with the kind of the modern scientific strategies to protect wild rice?
So we try to do our co-management. So, for instance, Jason Fleener and I are co-chairs for the Joint State Tribal Wild Rice Committee. So this is where science and culture kind of come together, you know, for co-management decisions, you know, with Manoman. So I'm able to offer up, you know, some of the traditional ways of thinking or some of the teachings, you know, to help with the science side, the Western way of thinking, too. So that's where we kind of come together, you know, to be able to do co-management, you know, for Manoman.
And Jason, how do you view it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this partnership is very critical. The state working with tribes, and I give a lot of credit to all the Ojibwe tribes, Glyphwick, and even other tribes in Wisconsin who have done so much work for wild rice. Wisconsin DNR staff do a lot to manage rice and protect it, but there's only so much we can do. So the partnership, we really complement each other's work well, I think.
And I would imagine other organizations could play a role too, like Wisconsin Wetlands Association or something, a group like that.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of different organizations interested in conserving rice, and it's sometimes it just starts with education. Facilitating webinars, shows like this, for example, or research. There's a lot of academic researchers, institutions around the Midwest. There's a lot more wild rice research going on now than I think there's ever been done. So, duck hunting organizations, Ducks Unlimited, Wisconsin Waterfowl Association are doing a lot of work for wild rice. They really recognize its importance, not just for rice, but also the effect it has on ducks and other species.
Barry in Viroqua has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Barry.
Yes, good morning. Considering the threat to wild rice and the habitat, has there been any experimentation with trying to replicate the cold conditions? I know this probably sounds crazy, but to replicate the cold conditions and then germinate the rice and then transplant it. Has there been any experimentation with that?
Interesting. Kathleen, do you want to start and Jason can pipe in?
Sure. University of Minnesota had a student that actually took Manomen seed from a couple of sites, around the Twin Cities. They were able to overwinter it. So they wanted to know, when it germinated, what were the conditions. So that was a pretty interesting study. She had just finished up her thesis. So sometimes what I'll do is through research, I'll support or be an advisor, to some of the young researchers. So her research really showed, what temperatures that it needed to be at, what water bodies. So it was kind of like preliminary findings, at when that seed would germinate. But as far as I know some people, apart from the research that tried to start the seed and then it's really difficult to transplant Manomen because it needs to stick into, substrate, which is really difficult. I've tried it, where if I see a Manomen, floating on the top, and I've even tried to use my paddle to kind of stick it back into the substrate. Sometimes it's very difficult. Sometimes it works. So it's, pretty difficult. I've known a tribe in southern Michigan, too, that has done that. But I'm not sure what the success had been.
Yeah, go ahead, Jason, as well.
Yeah, I guess I don't have anything else to add. There's, like I said, there's so much research going on right now, a lot of different laboratory studies, but there are none others that I'm aware of that like looked at germination temperatures. But whenever people do research with wild rice in a laboratory setting, they really have to be careful because it is, like Kathy said, hard to raise in a lab setting and then transplant into the wild, if you will, and to be successful.
Let's take another call. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Stella.
Hi. My question is concerning PFAS. Are the waters that the wild rice is growing in polluted with PFAS, and does the plant take them up, and has there been any testing done to see if there is PFAS in the wild rice?
Jason?
Yeah, it's interesting you should ask that question because there is some research UW-Madison is looking at that very question. They're collecting wild rice in the St. Louis River estuary, which is just outside of Superior, Wisconsin, and some of the more polluted areas to see if there is PFAS uptake. So I don't think we have answers to that yet, but I think that is a very important question to see if there is any contamination in the environment that would affect humans as we eat it.
Yeah, it certainly would be. Someone else is wondering, when can wild rice be harvested in Wisconsin? Jason, what do you?
Sure, I can take that one. So it depends, but generally speaking, late August, about the last week of August and the first 2 weeks of September. So really, as we speak, I would say right now is kind of the tail end of the harvest season, but that really depends on the lake or river. Generally speaking, and Kathy confirmed, I think usually rivers tend to, their rice tends to ripen a little earlier than some of the bigger lakes do. But yeah, late August, early September, and it's really important when harvesters go out to test the rice first, and if it's not falling immediately, then they should back out and then come a few days later until it's ripe.
Yeah. Kathleen, anything to add there?
Yes. So I always shoot for Labor Day weekend. So that's a good indicator for when Monoman is, you know, ready to rock and roll. But like Jason had said, you always got to test that ripeness of rice. If that first part, which is usually the top that ripens first, is not offering itself up, is to, you know, definitely, you know, think about it and come back at a later time, because you don't want to harvest green wild rice because it's not ready yet.
John in Price County called, couldn't stay with us, asked if non-native people can grow wild rice, and if so, where can they get advice for growing it on their property?
Yeah, I guess I could take that one. So yeah, wild rice, whether if it's a public water or a private water, there aren't any restrictions or permits needed to plant it. If it's done on a private body water, like a pond, you know, it will be most successful, like as Kathy mentioned before, if there's an inlet or outlet, a spring or some very small flow of water, that's where it really thrives. So, you know, one could go out and harvest themselves and then transplant that anywhere that they want to plant it. The only thing that DNR recommends is if they do it on a public body of water, is to be very mindful of where you plant it. And if there are a lot of, there's a lot of boat traffic or shoreline owners that might not be welcoming of planting it in a certain spot, then it's probably not the right place.
Yeah. So how do we protect? Both of you can comment on this. Maybe start with you. How can individuals do to help ensure wild rice beds flourish, Kathleen?
So we want to be mindful, like Jason said, first you got to be able to identify, you know, our beautiful relative. So educate yourself on where wild rice is, what it looks like, especially that most vulnerable stage, you know, at the floating leaf stage. So that's when we try to stay out of the rice beds, especially with motorized boats. Canoes will kind of, you know, gently flow over the floating leaf stage, but it's best to kind of stay out of it. So then that way, you know, it could continue to age and to be able to stand up. So that's the best thing that I could say is just, you know, educate yourself about Monoman and where it's at, the habitat. Even if you go into a lake, you know, you can also go to the Wisconsin DNR site, and it will state that, you know, rice is in that water body.
Yeah. And so that's a feature, Jason, that the DNR does to kind of help with wild rice.
Yeah, so on the Wisconsin DNR website, dnr.wi.gov, you could search for wild rice harvesting, and it'll bring you to our webpage. And it has everything on there from harvest regulations to where to find wild rice. And there's an interactive web mapping tool where one could see if there is a presence of rice or not, especially in northern Wisconsin where it's been inventoried the heaviest. It doesn't necessarily say where it's located on that lake or how abundant it is, just if it's present. So that should give people a good idea of an awareness if it's there.
Mm. Well, I want to thank you both for taking time to talk with us today about wild rice and its production and its cultural meanings. Kathleen Smith from the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, one of our guests. Jason Fleener, a wetland habitat specialist for the Wisconsin DNR with a very strong interest in wild rice as well. Great to have both of you with us. Thank you so much. And we'll be turning our attention to carbon pricing next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. In the coming months and years, we're likely to pay much more to heat and cool our homes and fill our gas tanks. And there are some ways that perhaps we can mitigate that a bit by incentivizing energy companies to provide alternatives to fossil fuels. Larry Mueller here. And our guest with us now is Nick Roy, a researcher with Resources for the Future. Nick's going to explain how fees paid to the state by utility companies could result in lower energy bills for those of us here in Wisconsin. So, have you seen your energy bills increasing? Do you wonder how much more or less you would pay for clean or renewable energy? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Let's talk about your nonprofit, Resources for the Future. Tell us about that organization.
Yeah, so Resources for the Future is a nonpartisan, non-advocacy, nonprofit research institute based in Washington, D.C. We do a lot of work focusing on federal and state policy in the U.S., primarily using tools from economics as well as the fields of environmental science and other disciplines, mainly focusing on informing decision makers at the legislative level, but also at the executive level to think about how they can use economics to inform better decisions around resources and energy decisions.
So you're a nonprofit. How are you funded and able to operate?
Yeah, so it changes depending on the year. Like we've had a lot more government funding until this year, but historically we also have a lot of funding from foundations and we have a lot of individual contributors as well, but mostly other nonprofits that are looking to try and increase the amount of information that is around these topics.
So you're concerned certainly with the affordability of energy for the average home and business owner. What's really driving up the cost?
There's a lot of factors that have been longstanding as well as recent around electricity prices. So for many years now, we've been seeing a lot of constraints around permitting. And so that is both the permitting of transmission lines to new generation, as well as permitting for new sources of electricity generation. And that's been something that's been going on for some time now. And there's been bipartisan efforts at the federal level and several state levels to try and figure out how to sort of expedite that so we can unlock the energy resources we have in this country to be able to have lower prices. Now, in recent years, or actually really mostly this past year or two, there's been some other major trends that have begun to emerge. One is that demand growth, which has historically been relatively low in recent years, has begun to increase pretty substantially. And a big driver of that is, one driver of that is electrification of households as well as electric vehicles. But one that's been getting a lot more attention in the news lately has been AI data centers. And this is because of how much electricity is needed to be able to scale up this somewhat national priority, as well as booming economic sector in our economy. And then I'd say a third aspect of what is driving up these prices tends to be, or is the fact that there was a lot of subsidies towards clean generation being directed towards new solar and wind, as well as other technologies that are have zero emissions from the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022. In the reconciliation package that was just passed by the House here in Washington, D.C. in August, there was a lot of removal of those tax credits, especially for wind and solar, and especially for the coming years. And so as utilities are looking to plan new generation, they now have less subsidies that they can use to provide that generation at a lower cost, while they're simultaneously still facing these major barriers for siting that new generation, as well as transmission, and having to meet the demand of these AI data centers, which are have a great amount of electricity needed to operate for their purposes.
Do we know how much, these data centers, how much additional energy are they consuming?
Well, right now, because it's been such a rapidly growing industry, I'm not sure that the data has fully come out on exactly how much of an impact they're making. I will say that we have seen increases of electricity demand in the past year that were, I believe you could, what's the right number for it? Somewhere close to 10, a little over 10% higher than what we had expected in previous years. I guess what projected electricity demand was going to be for last year was about 10% higher in actuality. And that doesn't account for just how much demand we're expecting in this year. The nice thing about the power sector is because it's, you know, sort of this giant machine, the grid, there's a lot of planning that goes on. And so when these new data centers want to come online, they still have to work with utilities and so on to try and figure out how to become this very large load, and how the utilities and the grid operators can plan for that large load. So I would say that it's what's a big part of their effect on prices isn't necessarily how much they're demanding today, but how much they might demand in the future. And because of the uncertainty of exactly how much AI is going to play a role in, or the success of the AI and data centers that are needed to power it, the impact in terms of size is still kind of unknown. And I think they're trying to figure that out right now.
Yeah.
In the coming years, we'll have a lot more information on that.
Yeah, sure. And I know Wisconsin, I mean, we're looking at some big data centers, or at least one very large data center coming into the state, mm-hmm. which could have an impact on our state.
Yeah, and what's interesting also about Wisconsin is that there's, you know, obviously you're part of MISO, the Mid-Continental Independent System Operator, which is like sort of the grid that you share with other states. And there's other states nearby in MISO that are contribute to the prices that Wisconsinites pay and that utilities have to face that are scaling up and have been scaling up data centers for a while now. So Illinois and Iowa are in the top 15 states in terms of their data center, how much demand that consumes for their state electricity. And so while there are some arguments for having data centers in states, like you could get economic benefits from those jobs, Wisconsinites might be paying for other states to get those economic benefits in the electricity rates they face. And so it isn't just the case that you can say we don't want data centers in Wisconsin. You're going to have to pay for the data centers that you that share the same grid you do in other states.
Okay, and so how many other states are there? There's like four or five other states, and we're kind of paying for some of that.
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't know the specifics of MISO. It is one of the larger, I'm pulling up a map now, just so I can better answer you there. I just know that it's one of the larger independent system operators, and it spans several states. And, you know, whatever decisions are decided about how they want to integrate AI data centers into their state economic profile, like that does partially play into the increased demand that drives up electricity prices.
Well, we've got a lot more to talk about. Wisconsin's one of the 8 states that has clean energy policies. We're going to be talking about that. And certainly we're going to be talking about carbon pricing with our guest, Nick Roy. Research associate, works on national and state energy policy resources for the future. It's a research nonprofit focused on environmental and economic policies. And he will be with us right up until 12:30. Today, if I'm not mistaken. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on WPR, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about carbon pricing today with Nick Roy. Nick's a research associate for Resources for the Future. It's a research nonprofit focused on environmental and economic policy and based in Washington, D.C. You can join the conversation with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you, and we will get to the caller we have online in just a minute. But I want to go back to Wisconsin's clean energy policies. I think, Nick, you wrote an issue brief that says Wisconsin is one of 8 states with clean energy policies. How would you describe Wisconsin's commitment to clean energy?
Yeah, that's actually a great question, because I was thinking in particular, when we picked the states we looked at states that had what's known as renewable portfolio standard, which is essentially, or clean energy standards. There's sort of two different names for the same thing. And they essentially are ways of requiring a certain percentage of electricity provided to Wisconsinites, in this case, come from clean energy. And that percentage increases over time. And there's basically a crediting system that emerges such that the utilities that have a less clean mix pay the utilities that have a cleaner mix to be able to meet this statewide target. Now, Wisconsin's RPS hasn't been updated in some time. I think it was set at 10% and hadn't increased much greater than that. And I don't follow this very closely. This was more of like something that we were checking if there was states that had these policies. So it could be that there is active activity around that policy that I'm unaware of. But that hasn't stopped utilities from setting goals. I mean, from what I understand, most, I think all but one utility in Wisconsin has an 80% clean by 2030 target, or 80% below 2005 emissions levels. Those actually tend to be very similar when we're looking at national level, at least. 80% below 2005 is often the same as 80% clean. And actually, in this analysis, that was the exact policy that we modeled. We said, what if there was, instead of a RPS crediting system, what if we had an emissions trading system, which is another way of basically generating a carbon price? The details are kind of nuanced to get to, but essentially a carbon price can arise from meeting this target of 80% that all these utilities have. And so actually what we modeled here is sort of the cost that in theory utilities would already be paying, but if they face increased demand and that starts to lead to some backsliding on their goals, which are pretty much voluntary and it's hard to enforce, then this policy would be a way of holding those utilities accountable while also raising some revenues. And in the way we described it, those revenues could go back to households.
And we'll go into more detail on that, but I think in 2022, wind projects made up around 19% of solar, and solar accounted for about 3% of the state's total electricity generation. So we got wind and we got solar there, which is getting larger. And Mary Kay in Kenosha actually had a question about solar.
Let's
go there. Mary Kay, hi. What's on your mind?
Hi. My question to you about solar is solar farms, okay? Wisconsin is using up its farmland. People live near these solar farms, okay? We've never been told the health effects to the public and to the landscape. There's no signs, no warnings that you're near one when you're driving past one. And in the winter, the panels, because we have rough winters in Wisconsin, the panels are going to break, and there's chemicals in those panels. So I don't understand why we just don't use what we already have, use less, and they get a tax credit for trying to help.
Mary Kay, thanks for calling. Nicholas, Nick, what do you say?
Yeah, so I'm not a public health expert that can speak to the specific chemicals in solar panels and how they affect downstream. But of course, energy is a big concern in terms of our energy sources and how that interacts with our health. I would point to the fact that oftentimes what we already have tends to be what is polluting our air and water much more than, from what we understand today, solar panels or wind turbines could do. So when you look at coal, the amount of SO2 or sulfur dioxide that is released, that can have serious health implications and can lead to a lot of people dying. Now, the intersection that you bring up is particularly interesting when it comes to farms and the agricultural aspect of, you don't want your food to have chemicals that are poor. And I don't know the interactions in particularly of solar or coal on the downstream impacts on the agriculture sector. But there's definitely a lot of documented evidence about the harm that our existing coal and natural gas and fossil fuel supply tends to have on our public health. And I'd be interested in looking into the research on how it could affect downstream agricultural impacts. I think another thing I'd point out is that these fossil plants, coal and natural gas, one of the things that we're talking about a lot in this paper is climate. Those are going to affect global temperatures, and as well as conditions for agriculture are going to change as global temperatures increase over time. And so that could be a major impact on farmers in Wisconsin. The specifics, again, there are less of what I'm aware of, and I'd be really happy to talk with someone who, and maybe Larry, you want to have someone on who can talk about the intersection of agriculture and climate, as well as the intersection of fossil fuel generation and agricultural impacts.
Let's turn to talk a little bit more about the whole carbon pricing thing. Wisconsin does not have a policy of carbon pricing, but
no.
talk a bit more about what really carbon pricing is, and what are the details as you know them.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about that last question, the fundamental idea of carbon pricing is to have polluters pay. And so the pollution that you're making them pay for is the hidden tax that households already face of carbon dioxide when it comes to climate damages, as well as the associated sulfur oxide and nitrous oxide that comes from these plants. We've actually had a emissions pricing system exist across the U.S. for some time that eliminated acid rain. Historically, that was a major achievement of the Clean Air Act that I'm sure Wisconsinites, as well as many others, have benefited from across the U.S. But what this policy in particular does, instead of thinking about acid rain, it's thinking about the effects of climate change and focusing on making polluters pay for their carbon dioxide emissions. And there's two benefits there. One is that you're incentivizing less emissions. So the existing generation is going to cost more if it's polluting. So if you have coal or natural gas plants that that have high CO2, then they become less economic. I mean, it's already the case that they are, or coal plants in particular, have relatively uneconomic as is today. And a lot of what's supporting them is that increase in demand while the supply is constrained because of permitting. So you're getting increased demand from the data centers, which is forcing the use of these polluting resources while simultaneously you can't meet that demand with cheaper and cleaner renewables or clean energy. And sorry, I just was thinking again about that last input from the caller. And another point to make is that with carbon pricing, it doesn't necessarily say you got to build solar or wind. It actually leaves it to the market to come up with the solution. So there's other resources such as geothermal or nuclear, which maybe people have concerns about themselves as well, but it doesn't have to be left solely to the carbon price to decide what technology it is. You know, the PSC as well as your legislatures can provide other incentives beyond a carbon price to be able to direct what energy sources are used. What a carbon price does is it puts a price on carbon and gets those revenues, as well as makes those polluters pay that tax they're already making households pay. And we can talk a bit more about what you can do with the revenues, I guess, if you have any question on that. But
yeah,
I want to make sure I address the carbon pricing idea well.
Well, one that comes to mind right away in terms of what you can do with it, part of it, at least I would think, would go back to the consumer.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, and that's the revenue usage we describe in the report. I mean, with the subsidies pulled away from renewables and other clean energy sources right now, the revenues you could generate from a carbon price can actually perfectly supplement. And in other states, it would exceed the levels those subsidies did. In Wisconsin, it's actually much closer one-to-one in our analysis. But yeah, those revenues, if you give them back to households, they actually will see a decrease in their electricity rates while also having a cleaner grid. Now, it's important to note that that's only if you address some of these broader concerns of permitting that we brought up at the beginning, which make it harder to be able to integrate these new energy sources. And if, you know, locals are concerned about the integration of those resources, it's going to take some time to reconcile those concerns and figure out how to properly address them while to also be able to capture the benefit of that carbon pricing. Now, one thing to note is those revenues are collected across the cost of generating across the entire power sector. So households are just one component of the power sector. If you are a data center, you're not a household. You are part of the industrial or commercial sector. And what happens is if you rebate households with those carbon pricing revenues, that you've collected, you're basically making those not only the polluters pay, but if the polluters pass on the cost to ratepayers, you're shielding households from that potential cost pass through and the other sectors that are increasing demand in the electricity sector are the ones who are going to face that increase in price.
So those companies, they're users, they're not producers, so they're not paying a carbon. Well, they would be paying it, I guess.
And it depends on how there's a couple different ways to do it. One could be that you integrate. I mean, this is the interesting thing about carbon pricing. There's so many different ways to iron out the details and implementation. In some cases, you could give the allowances for free and just give less and less over time. In that case, you're not going to get any revenues to redistribute. But if you do that, you could have utilities that have cleaner energy will have more revenues because they will be selling their allowances to other utilities that have dirtier programs, kind of similar to the RPS system that has existed historically. And when they do that, you could require that, especially because there's regulated utilities in Wisconsin, you could require that they give those revenues back to households. So that's one way that could be done. But it could also be the case that if you're sort of requiring the polluters all to pay and they have to pay the government based on the carbon price that is set or the goal that is set that creates a carbon price, then there's a question of how much those utilities pass that on to ratepayers. And the point that we're making here is that in theory, they're likely to pass it either entirely to, you know, all customer classes or figure out a way to sort of distribute it across these different types of ratepayers. And if you have all these revenues left over, it's good to target households to receive those revenues instead of giving it to all of the other sectors.
And so that revenue, I mean, so consumers, but also I'm thinking that it could go to expansion of clean energy.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point too, that other states have thought of doing this. There's these concepts called greenhouse gas reduction funds, which are thinking about how we use those revenues to invest in that. But when I looked at Wisconsin State Energy Plan, something that stood out to me was the investments, particularly in workforce development. I mean, when you look outside of the United States, there's a lot of growth in these technologies when it comes to solar and wind and advanced nuclear and so on that don't produce carbon dioxide. And if our industrial workforce falls behind and becomes too committed to energy that is, you know, dependent on volatile global markets or, you know, finite resources instead of the infinite resources that are wind and solar, then it could be that, you know, that could have extreme workforce implications in the long run. And so what I liked about looking at Wisconsin's clean energy plan that I believe the governor's office conducted was that they talked a lot about this sort of workforce development angle. And that to me is a great way to use these revenues as well, because it's not giving the money, you know, you're not taking it from, you know, the power sector and then giving it back to the power sector to invest into the clean energy. You're, you know, taking it from the power sector and you're saying, now let's invest it in jobs that can help lower the cost or accelerate the role households and constituents have in that transition that's occurring.
That's cool. Michael emailed to say only 20% of our energy diet comes from electricity. The remainder is mostly fossil fuels. Will carbon prices affect the 80% non-electric fossil fuel use?
So what we describe in this paper that we were talking about here is specifically focusing on a carbon price on the power sector. So it's mostly about switching the fuels from polluting electricity generation to non-polluting electricity generation over time. And you can apply a similar concept across an entire economy. Like you could include oil refineries, you could include cement and limestone and other sectors that do create a lot of CO2. But that we haven't analyzed the impacts of that in this paper here. Two states in the U.S. have these policies where they cover other sectors. So that's Washington and California. And the European Union is starting to expand there, as well as China. They have a carbon price that is starting to cover more sectors. So there are programs that are already addressing this. But really, it's hard to think about decarbonizing these other sectors. So like, you know, getting people to switch to electric vehicles, for example, if you aren't prioritizing emissions reductions in the power sector first. And that's because most emissions reductions from those other sectors rely on electrification. And if your grid is still powered by fossil fuels, you might not be producing CO2 emissions with your electric vehicle, but if that electric vehicle is charged on a dirty grid, well, then the impacts are somewhat offset. So I think that that's the reason we focus particularly on the power sector here. But of course, in the long run, and especially as, you know, if we get really serious about addressing our climate goals, then other sectors become a higher priority as well.
So we've got the federal government phasing out tax credits for clean energy. How will this affect the cost of energy for the average American?
Yeah, so this has been an open question in some ways because of the fact that there is a lot of uncertainty around exactly how this phase out is going to play out. There's in the way that the law has been interpreted by the Treasury Department, there's still sort of leaving some room for legal interpretation about exactly if a project can receive these tax credits if it is built in 27, in 28, 29. There's sort of open questions about exactly how the prices are going to change. In a separate analysis from this, we found that the repeal of these tax credits is expected to increase electricity prices by 6 to 8%. That includes some demand growth projections. But of course, if demand continues to grow beyond expectations like it has historically, and we don't resolve some of our larger transmission issues and the costs that they impose on the power sector, well, then that could look a lot more significant. One thing that has been an idea floating around Washington as well as other states is thinking about not even necessarily clean energy versus dirty energy, but just the fact that we need cheap energy right now because of all this demand growth. And one thing that's nice about clean energy is that it is relatively cheap. And what is helpful about these carbon prices is while they might be increasing the cost of dirty energy, that dirty energy is probably only going to stay online if you're having demand growth from, like we've said, data centers or some other customer class that can kind of afford to keep these plants online. You see this there's retired plants in the East Coast, that such as Three Mile Island, which had a nuclear disaster. Mm-hmm. Microsoft bought Three Mile Island and basically kept it going, even though it was expected to retire in the near future. And so and that's very costly energy because of the fact that there was a nuclear meltdown with that. So and you see this too with coal plants that were expected to close and data centers bringing them online just so that they can supply their energy. And I guess the point that I'm trying to make here is that, you know, if the data centers are the reason that dirty fossil stays online and how we meet their rising demand, then maybe households should be receiving some of the benefits too, and also being compensated for some of the costs that dirty energy is going to have on their health and the climate.
It seems like here we're talking about this in a state-by-state level, which suggests that the state should do it if the federal government won't.
Yeah, I mean, this is really an opportunity, I think, to show what it looks like to be able to care about your environment while also doing things, while also addressing affordability concerns. I mean, that is a sort of central question that is going on nationally as well as in most states, is questions of how can we lower costs. And the environmental concerns have somewhat been characterized historically, and I think mischaracterized in a lot of ways, as something that increased costs. Like if you care about the environment, that must increase costs. But the reality is that most of us pay costs for not caring about our environment all the time. Like I said, with air pollution, water pollution, and climate pollution. And so really the goal here is especially a state like Wisconsin in the Midwest, there isn't any major carbon pricing systems that exist, but there has been clean energy policy thought about throughout the Midwest. I think this is a real opportunity to show how to implement a policy in a smart way that is different from the sort of coastal states that have already implemented carbon pricing. And that's because the coastal states have other constraints and other regulations that they tend to couple with carbon pricing. But if Wisconsin were to implement only carbon pricing and do this rebate in this way, it could really show how if states simplified their policy approach towards the environment, that that's part of what can make energy more affordable and our environments much cleaner.
Have you received any support for your proposal from Wisconsin lawmakers?
Well, we don't do any advocacy at Resources for the Future, so we're entirely just trying to provide information into this space. And in a lot of ways, we're really floating ideas, and we're not trying to push this idea. I think I leave it to democracy and the legislative process to be able to figure out exactly what works for Wisconsinites. I will say that if any, like we haven't been, because of that non-advocacy approach, we tend to not lobby, but we do work with legislatures if they have questions, specifically technical ones. And so I really hope today that through this conversation, you know, some constituent starts thinking about this, maybe gets involved in some local policy thinking, and that they start to reach a point where, whether it's carbon pricing or other environmental policy, that we could maybe work with Wisconsin legislatures to think about this kind of policy.
Yeah, and Wisconsin, and we do have occasionally, at for sure, have Wisconsin lawmakers listening to this program. So maybe we're making a little providing some information for them. The seven state, why you picked those seven states? And
yeah.
What are the other? Is Arizona?
Who are the Colorado? Other? Yeah, I mean, I need to pull up.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
New Mexico, Michigan. Michigan's on there. Illinois, another, and Minnesota. All your neighbors except for Iowa.
So, would it make sense to have the seven getting together at all and talking about this?
That is a really great question, and that is something that we see in the Northeast. So there's a 10-state carbon pricing system in the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that exists right now, and they work together to basically implement their carbon pricing system. And that program recently had an update that was focusing on addressing affordability concerns that I think was pretty successful, according to most market watchers and economists who are paying attention to that. Yeah, the one thing to note that's really beneficial about having these states come together and collaborate is that if you have a target spread out across the multi-states, which, as we mentioned before, you might be sharing a grid, so you might as well do it that way anyway, it allows you to find more cost-effective ways to reduce emissions. And so that means that the price of electricity, even on those who will pay for it, even if they don't get a rebate, like households will, as we proposed, that impact will be lower. So that's one benefit. The other is, to your caller's point earlier, if people don't want to have solar panels in their backyard, or they're worried that the land's going to be used because Wisconsin is such an important agricultural hub for the Midwest, then maybe it makes sense to figure out other locations within the grid that supplies the Midwest electricity, where you could place solar or wind or offshore wind even. I mean, the Great Lakes region has a lot of wind around it because of its geography. And so I think that's another example of a technological opportunity. Or perhaps you have, you know, some part of these other states that is really, really excited about these new technologies, and maybe less so than Wisconsin. And so you could have a combined system where you still reach the same reductions in CO2 in terms of climate impacts, and you'll do it more cost effective, and you'll have it in places where people actually want these technologies. At the same time, I would note that you do lose a little bit of the benefit of the reduced emissions, as well as the workforce development opportunities, if you don't deploy those technologies in your state.
Yeah, fascinating. And I really enjoyed reading your piece. Nick, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it. Now, hopefully we'll have a chance to talk again down the road. Thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it, Larry. I hope so too.
Nick Roy, a research associate working on national and state energy policy, Resources for the Future, a research nonprofit focused on environmental and economic policies. Great to have him with us. And coming up, we're going to switch gears and talk with you about prescribed burning and how you might become a burn boss. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Mm-hmm. Prescribed burning is a time-honored land management strategy for prairies and parkland, but it's essential that the people who conduct these burns know what they're doing. Otherwise, they risk fires getting out of control and spreading. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about a new Burn Boss training program with a couple of guests, Jeb Barzin, one of them, chairman of the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council, and an ecologist for Private Lands Conservation LLC in Spring Green. Jeb, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's great to be here again. Thank you.
Always fun to talk with you. Also with us today, Christina Weld. Christina, a training specialist for the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council. And Christina, welcome to you. Thanks for joining in.
Thanks. My pleasure.
As we talk with our guests, I hope you'll join in. Have you watched a prescribed burn? We always call them controlled burns. I think that's what we used to call them. I'm going to ask you about that. Anyway, prescribed burns, maybe you've marveled at the foliage that springs up after a burn. Or what would you like to get trained to take part in prescribed burns? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Jeb, let's start with you. You're chairman of the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council. Talk about what the council does, its goals.
Well, you know, the bottom line is we're the only organization in the state who's solely focused on getting more fire on the ground safely and effectively. And that's because we need it. There's estimates that we need to be burning 1 million acres a year just to maintain the rich diversity that we're blessed by in Wisconsin. But we only are getting done about 75,000 acres a year. Out of a million. And so there's a huge gap between where we know we need to be and where we are right now. And so the Fire Council's wanting to try to take this on, not solely, but through partnerships. We're certainly anxious and willing and engaged to figure out ways of making that happen throughout the state.
So when and where is prescribed burning? I mean, you talked about 1 million acres. And we've got a lot more acreage than that in the state. When and where is it needed?
There are fire adapted communities everywhere in Wisconsin, and most of the species that are in decline right now are in decline in part because there isn't that fire. So it's a tremendously important resource that's out there, but even all the CRP lands and EQIP programs and Partners for Wildlife and lots of different programs like that are all dealing with these what we call ecosystems that need fire. And so they'll even do things like give us more water, give us more carbon stored, and do all kinds of things in addition to protecting species. So pretty much the whole state is fair game, but how we approach each part of the state is a different question.
Yeah. Christina, I turn to you. How did you get involved in this? I mean, what's your background?
Yeah. So I got into this when I bought a parcel of land in Sauk County and moved on to 30 acres of woodlands that I then had to figure out what needed to happen with. And I was lucky enough to work with a DNR forester who was like, hey, you have some cool spaces here that could benefit from some prescribed fire. And that actually caused me to take a career change into conservation and ultimately prescribed fire.
Wow. There you go. So what knowledge and skills does a person need to safely conduct a prescribed burn?
A lot. It really depends on where you are in the scheme of the burn in terms of leadership. So when you're first starting out prescribed fire, you're just going to be a crew member on a burn. So you're not having to make a lot of decisions. You're getting pretty clearly told what to do, where to go. But you still have to understand how the weather impacts the fire, how the topography impacts the fire, how your ignitions might impact the fire, and then when and where and how to keep the fire in the box. And that's just at that basic crew level. As you advance, you can be a squad boss where you're directing those crew members, usually 3 to 5 people, on basically a half of the fire. And then above the squad boss, you have your burn boss. And they really have to have the full picture of all of the notifications needed, the permits, where to start the fire, whether that's an appropriate day to do that fire or whether a different day would be better. So really, depending on where you are in that hierarchy, you know, the skills have to increase as you go up.
Typically in a prescribed burn, what's the kind of acreage are we talking about? Is there some average or not?
Really any acreage. So it can be anywhere from someone's rain garden that might be 10 feet by 10 feet that still provides great pollinator habitat and benefits from burning, to hundreds or thousands of acres in contiguous wildlife management areas or woodlands.
You know, and you can do good work on any of those scales, and you can also mess up on any of those scales. So, you know, you always have to be careful if you're putting fire on the ground, because you can make mistakes, and that's the point of the training. But I also kind of want to mention one other thing. Christina's description of how she got involved with prescribed fire, I think, is really fun. And I know this is radio, but I swear I saw a lot of your listeners nodding their head as saying they are, you know, experiencing the same sort of thing. And Wisconsin's 85% privately owned. And so if we're going to move the dial in terms of getting more fire on the ground safely and effectively, we have to be doing things that help Wisconsin landowners that are, you know, for private landowners, as much as we do help nonprofit organizations or working with DNR or with other organizations that are interested in fire. And I think that's an important distinction, because everything that Christina said is true. But how we go about training a private landowner to burn on their own property is really different and relatively much easier than it is to train somebody to burn throughout the, you know, southern third of Wisconsin, you know, multiple times, you know, in the year and that sort of thing. And so the Burn Academy is more for the professional end of the gradient. And, but we also are trying to reach out with private landowners to figure out how we can empower them to do safe and effective prescribed burns on their own property. And that's a really a different concept.
A different concept entirely. Talking about prescribed burns today and the Burn Boss program with our two guests, Jeb Barzin, chair of the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council, and an ecologist in private lands conservation for Private Lands Conservation LLC. It's headquartered in Spring Green. Christina Weld, the training specialist for the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council. Questions for them, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you can email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, talking today with Jeb Barzin and Christina Wells about prescribed burns and the program that they have going that is looking at how you might become a burn boss, or how might you learn to really do a proper job with a prescribed burn. And you can join in. The number is 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. How many people do we currently have who are skilled and, you know, meet the qualifications to be involved in lead a prescribed burn?
Well, that's part of the problem, Larry. We don't know.
Oh.
You know, there hasn't been traditionally a way to keep track of that, and there hasn't been even a traditional way of defining what those qualifications are. So when the Fire Council decided to begin work with the Department of Natural Resources, the very first thing that we had to do is just start kind of saying, well, what does a prescribed burn boss in Wisconsin really need to know? And how do we get people to a place where they can learn that? And so we started really from scratch.
Corey in Dodgeville has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Larry. My question is about insurance. I have been part of professional and private prescribed burns, and I'm especially interested in what we need to be telling private landowners about intentionally setting fires, which I totally agree we need to be doing more of, but how do they ensure that they're protected?
Good question. Jeb, any idea?
It is a great question, and it's a complicated answer for any individual landowner. So there are some commercial private insurance companies that will insure you for doing a prescribed burn on your own property. But some of them won't, or some of them think they will, but don't communicate very well. And so it's hard to figure it out. There aren't a lot of people who are demanding for it. And so oftentimes local insurance agents won't necessarily know the real answer to that. But there are some local commercially available insurance companies that will do that. If you're looking for insurance where, you know, as I described, where you're looking at doing burns for other people, you know, or several burns each year and in different lands and different land ownerships and that sort of thing, that's a different sort of insurance that you would need. And that's is available, but from a much smaller set of companies that can provide that. And we have a lot of information on the Wisconsin Prescribed Fire Council's website, if you're interested in looking that up. And our website is www.prescribedfire.org with an emphasis on the bark.
On the bark. Oh, man. So do it once more for me.
www.prescribedfire.org. Pretty much as you would hope it to be.
Corey, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, gosh. So the number of people, how do you determine the number of people that would be needed for a prescribed burn? You mentioned, Christina, you mentioned, maybe five, but that was, I'm sure, just sort of an example.
Yeah, so it really ranges. It depends on your unit size, the unit complexity, the experience of those involved, the type of weather you're burning under. So the kind of standard number that, like, if you don't have anything else to go off of, you could say seven is maybe an average. You know, big units is obviously going to take more. It could be up to as many as 20 people if you have a large complex unit. If you have a really small unit or you're burning in the evening, which a lot of landowners will do, the fire behavior tends to be much more muted and you can safely burn with just one or two people. So it really, there's so many variables that go into making that decision of how many people you need and how much expertise those people need to have.
It's a great answer for why training is needed.
Wind, somebody wondered about wind and how wind plays a factor in it. We had a little email on that. Wind plays a big factor, I'm pretty sure, Christina.
Yeah, so wind is actually, a really important thing to have some of. Of winds. Yeah, ideally. So there's kind of, right, if you have too strong of a wind, then you're going to get a lot faster moving fire, longer flame lengths. It's going to be harder to keep in the box. There are some times when the prescription calls for that, and that's part of why we call it prescribed fire now instead of controlled burns, is that we have a prescription for the weather parameters that we need to get the fire behavior that we need to get the outcomes that we're desiring. And so depending on your unit, there may be times where a higher wind is appropriate, but generally you want a light to middling wind. so that you know which direction the wind's going to be moving and you can plan your burn around that so that your ignition strategy is working with that known wind direction. If you have no wind, then the fire kind of gets to decide what it wants to do. And in that case, the fire will sometimes do what we call chasing fuel, where it finds good fuel and it gets hotter, and that drives the fire to keep moving that direction, which might not be what you want it to do. But since there's no wind to dictate a direction, then you can get some really unpredictable fire behavior.
I was saying, as you were talking, I was thinking back to when I was probably 13 years old and on a neighboring farm when there was a burn done in a marsh, and I was on kind of on one side of this patch, and they had sort of a backfire lit, and I was going to run over to the other side because my buddy was there, and then I thought, maybe I shouldn't. It looked like a pretty big area, and suddenly that fire whipped across, and there's no way I would have made it across. That gave me a healthy respect. and I thought to myself, well, for once you didn't do something stupid. And I didn't. Oh my gosh. So let's talk about the actual training itself. And Jeb had mentioned there were a couple different kinds, but Christina, talk about the training for a burn boss.
Yeah. So we are offering our inaugural Burn Boss Academy this September 22nd through 26th. We currently have a class of 28 folks enrolled. So we do have a couple openings. If there's someone out there listening that wants to email us right away and get in, we could possibly still make that happen. So that's going to cover kind of four broad areas. It's going to cover fire ecology. So why we burn and how we make decisions about what should get burned, when and why. Fire behavior, burn plan writing, and then fire leadership. And so those are kind of the broad categories that we felt in our work with the DNR as we developed this curriculum of what we really felt a burn boss needed to know. This class is for those folks that are experienced at burns. So they may already be doing a little bit of burn bossing on smaller, simple units, and they want to increase their knowledge so that they can burn more complex units or more different fuel types than what they're currently used to. We have other classes. We have a squad boss training happening this fall and a private landowner training happening this fall that are kind of those earlier steps to help people be a crew member or a squad boss building their way towards a burn boss.
Okay, so the one is for the burn boss one is for people who have had some experience. So you, mm-hmm. you need to, there must be, or is there some sort of requirement in terms of the amount of experience that the person's had?
Yeah, so we recommend that the person has been a squad boss on at least 10 burns and has done at least 25 burns. Most of our applicants have burn bossed at least a couple of burns, but that's not to say that someone isn't just a very experienced squad boss and hasn't quite been ready to take that next step and is looking for some of that classroom and guided learning to help them feel comfortable with that.
And so, and this is a kind of a nice segue in terms of distinguishing what our approach is for private landowners, because again, this training is geared more towards a professional end of the spectrum, if you want to call it that. For private landowners, it's really hard to take a week out to go to the academy or to, you know, meet the criteria that Christina is outlining. But what we want to do with private landowners, and Christina is involved with this through prescribed burn associations or just interacting with private landowners, is to help step them through learning about fire in a safe way and gradually using that concept of a prescription to gradually get a little bit stronger in each of your iterations. So what I mean by that is I work with potato growers, as you may remember, Larry, and you know, when I've had them learn how to do their burns in a very short period of time, I can do the basic training so that they can be safe. And I can set them up with a fairly rigid prescription saying you can burn this pivot corner if it's burning into a dirt field and you have to use a wind direction that moves the fire into the dirt field. That's pretty simple, and it doesn't take a lot of experience. It doesn't take the experience that Christina is talking about to teach people to do that. And then as they get more competency or they get more comfortable with prescribed fire, you can then escalate, or you can make that prescription a little bit more open, which means that they need to, it's a little bit more complicated. And that's kind of the concept that we're trying to explore with private landowners is that they're in a different circumstance, and it's a lot easier to teach them how to burn their own land, which they typically know very well. And we can step them through that over time using the advantage that they're there.
Yeah.
And use that to our advantage in terms of the training. So the training, we don't call it a prescribed burn boss, but we can achieve the same results so that a private landowner can eventually be able to competently boss a burn on their property. But we just do it through a really different means because their circumstance is so different. You know, they've got a different, you know, they've got another life, and they can't, you know, put all the time and effort to kind of get that training up front and then deploy that, you know, extensively. So that's kind of what really what we're meaning, in that our overall goal is to get more fire on the ground safely and effectively. And however that we can do that, we are game to try. And private landowners offer a very different opportunity than, say, professional burn bosses.
Yeah. Gene's wondering, do you ever do prescribed burns in woodlands?
All the time.
Yeah. And the advantage of or disadvantage of it?
Well, they're a little bit more complicated, you know, so in how you can have a fire escape or the trouble is different than it is in prairies. Christina laid out well, in a prairie, if all of a sudden the wind changes direction or drops off, and you described, Larry, where all of a sudden things can become dangerous in a hurry. In a woods, that's less likely to happen. But in the woods, you can get embers to lodge on dead materials up in branches that don't start kindling for a half an hour or an hour. And so you have to know that so that you can go back and patrol your lines enough so that you can catch that circumstance. And so how mistakes occur is really different in the woods than not. And, you know, just as one example. So yes, woods do need fire. Oaks basically really aren't going to survive in Wisconsin without fire, you know, on a long-term basis. You know, our oak forests are already converting to maple and basswood and buckthorn. You know, that's the bottom line, is how to kind of get this to work across that whole big spectrum.
And so for either to be a burn boss or to learn, if you're a private landowner listening in, we've got a lot of them listening in, where do they go online to get the information they need?
Yeah, so I'd recommend they go check out our website. That would be, as Jeb said earlier, prescribedfire.org. And our news and events tab, if you go there under our events, you'll see all the trainings we have planned out for this fall. And there's a whole lot of other resources on there as well. So highly recommend, we've got resources for understanding fire ecology, resources for actually implementing the burn. So a lot of really good information there for folks in addition to our events.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking time to be with us today, and we'll get an update from you down the road, see how this burn boss and the private landowner training is going. Jeb Barzin and Christina Weld, our guests today. It's great to have them with us, and it's great to have you listening in, and a big thanks to Claire Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, and Jill Nador, executive producer. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for listening.